When it's hot and humid, most people can get themselves into a comfortable place, maybe in the shade or in air conditioning, and once you're there, you can perk yourself up with a cool beverage. But that doesn't work for our garden plants. They can't just pull up roots and move to a different spot, and they rely on either rain or the garden hose to bring them some water. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. There are many jobs that a gardener takes on, and watering when it's needed is certainly one of the most important. And Barb Larson, our guest today, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha County, can talk with us about watering and a whole bunch of more things relating to the garden. So I hope you'll join in as we visit with her today. Barb, thanks for coming by.
I'm very happy to be here again.
The number to call if you would like to join in, have a question for Barb, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post a photo and or question on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. How's your garden doing with the heat you've been having? Are some plants loving it? Give us a call. Let us know what's going on. Questions about watering? Barb's happy to help. And speaking of watering.
Yep.
We
need to keep our fingers crossed that we're going to get a pretty good rainfall when this cool front comes through. So I think it's going to be really important to, I'm a great fan of rain gauges so that I know how much I'm getting. So especially with these thunderstorms that come through where some areas may get a half an inch or an inch and, you know, you go a mile or so down the road and you get nothing, it's really important to know so you know how much to water and consider how you're going to do it. So that deep watering is really important. I talked to somebody this week that they were having trouble with a lot of their vegetables and talked about how were they watering it. And they were just going out with a, you know, hose and standing there for, you know, a couple of minutes and sprinkling it. It's like, no, that's not going to do it. Those roots are down, you know, a good 6-8 inches, and you need to get the water down to where those roots are. So that deep and frequent watering.
That's the way to go. An inch a week or so we need?
Yeah, that's kind of the rule of thumb for most plants is an inch a week, whether it's rainfall or whether we do it ourselves. And I always tell people water once or twice a week instead of every night, but water deeply.
Okay. What about fertilizing? How do you know when the plants need to have a little fertilizer?
Well, annual plants, you need to maybe think about a little fertilizer. I was just this past week looking at the containers on my patio, and I had slow-release fertilizer in the potting mix, and they were beginning to look a little sad, a little yellow. Part of it was the heat, but the other part was that fertilizer's now been used up. So I'm putting a liquid where I add to the water in my watering can, and about once a week I'm going to fertilize those ones in the containers. So keep an eye on them that way. Even if they're in the ground, you may need to look at that. Most perennials, trees and shrubs, don't need regular fertilization, and certainly we don't fertilize trees and shrubs in late summer. So
I have a lime tree in a pot, and I have to water that, and we put in, some sort of fish fertilizer.
Fish emulsion
that goes with the water.
Yep.
And that limey looks pretty healthy and is producing lots of limes.
So. No, that's good. So it must be you're getting the right thing with it.
Oh, man. Donnie Forrest has a question for you. Let's go to him. Hi, Don. Thank you for calling.
Thanks. I just planted like a little forest garden. And I'm having a real problem with Japanese beetles on a peach tree and on grapes that I planted. And I've tried a few things, and nothing seems to be working too well. I tried neem oil, and somebody suggested that, and they just seem to keep coming back. And
okay. Japanese beetles in some areas can be a real major problem. It's interestingly, you probably don't feel this way at all, but we've been talking in our kind of state horticulture updates for Extension that The number of Japanese beetles seem to be down overall this year, and it's probably because of last year's drought. But we do know in places they are pretty high, like they have been. One of the things, and you may find that you've got way too many, is to hand knock them off. So I usually go around with a little bucket of soapy water, and especially in the morning when it's a little bit cooler. I know it's not cool
knock
now, but knock them right out and into the bucket of soapy water. It just drowns them a little bit faster. Soapy water doesn't kill them. Because they're in the grapes and peaches, you're going to have to watch to any kind of insecticide needs to be labeled for Japanese beetles or for use in fruit crops. So you can't just use anything, and you're even going to have to be a little bit careful and watch on that label to the number of days between when you can spray and when it's safe to harvest. So I would look for some products like that, and there are several insecticides that you can use. The problem is you have to repeat treat. Now, the other thing that some people do is if you have a really large yard, like a half an acre or so, or even bigger, you can put a Japanese beetle trap way in the back corner away from your garden.
And it, your neighbor's garden.
That's right.
I didn't say that. So put it way, way away, and sometimes it will reduce the number that's up in near your plants. Part of the problem with grapes is grapes... Grapes are one of their favorites. I mean, they eat like 250 or 300 different kinds of plants, but grapes are one of the favorites.
So. Well, they had decimated the leaves on this peach tree. There's hardly a single leaf on there left.
Yeah, sometimes they'll do that. They'll just get picky on some particular plant and really beat it up. So.
And the other thing I heard about the lures is that they, you know, about half of the bugs that hit that lure bounce off and never go into the bag, and so now they're there, and they're looking around for something to eat. So
that's why we recommend not to use a trap in your close or in your own yard, especially if you're in an urban area. But people who have a really large property, or I'll tell you a couple of what I did a couple of years ago is two houses away from me, I have vacant lots where they haven't built. So I put it out in the middle of this big area, which was basically unmowed, you know, weed field, you know, because they haven't developed this. And it didn't get rid of them, but it did help pull a number of them out of the yard. So I had a few left or gone.
There you go, Don. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. John in Oshkosh, it is your turn. Hi, John.
Good afternoon. How are you, Ms. Naylor? Or good morning, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's no problem. Great. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Your guest had mentioned earlier in your program about deep watering. I was just curious. Could she expand on that? How, is it just a matter of soaking really well, or is it... Is there an actual something you could do to really get that water down into the roots?
No. Watering slowly and until it gets soaks down deeply. So one of the things I like to do is use either a soaker hose or trickle or something like that and let it run it for an hour or so and then see how far down it's gotten wet. And my kind of cheating, it's not cheating, but the easy way to do it is I use a bamboo stake, but you can also straighten a coat hanger or you can use anything that's kind of long and narrow. And then after it soaks in, I push that down, that rod down into the ground. And when I run into resistance, that's the dry soil. Then I can pull it up, kind of mark it with my finger, pull where the ground line is, pull it up and see how far down it's gotten wet. And then I know that if I run that soaker hose or that sprinkler for an hour, I know it usually gets wet down, you know, an inch or 2 inches or something like that. And I don't have to necessarily do it every time.
That's great advice. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much for calling. And a soaker hose, of course, is one of those flat hoses that you see
right.
with holes in it.
Yeah, and, you know, there's different ones. So there's the one that have the holes in it. There's the ones that kind of ooze. They take a little bit longer to do it. But I like those for a lot of, not only vegetables, but for a lot of our flowers, because it keeps the leaves dry. And so I can water during the day. And I have one soaker hose where it's kind of an oozer, so I can even, it takes so long for it to ooze out enough water to get down very far, I can even turn it on in the morning and let it slowly ooze all day and then turn it off when I get home. So,
our guest today, Barb Larson, horticulture educator with UW Extension in Kenosha County. I'm Larry Mueller here on Garden Talk. You can join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a photo, question, or a comment there. And, of course, we would love to hear from you. Any tomatoes, of course, are, you know, probably the favorite vegetable or fruit, if you want to call it, that we have here in the state. Any tomato diseases that are showing up yet?
Yeah, sadly, we are having reports, especially in the center part of the state, on late blight, which was a problem a couple of years ago. It's a real issue in tomatoes, not only for homeowners, but for commercial producers and for our potato production areas. So it has pretty distinctive kind of spot on the leaf. Even almost looks sometimes described as kind of a watery splotch. It, to me, it looks like if you had a green piece of paper and you dropped water on it and it kind of dissipated, that's kind of what the leaf looks like. It will also affect the fruits. So I would say anybody that's starting to get disease on your tomato leaves, you may want to check out. There's great pictures on our horticulture website for not only late blight disease, but also our typical leaf diseases, which are the septoria and the early spot, which cause more dark kind of spots on the leaves. So those aren't as big a concern, but if you think you may have late blight, you might want to, or we'd actually appreciate you getting a sample into the, your local county extension office so that we can kind of keep track of where it is going on in the state. With late blight, sadly, we want you to get rid of the plants. For the other leaf diseases, you can do things like make sure you keep the leaves dry, get good air circulation through them, and usually we can get crops off of it.
Barb in Oshkosh has a question. Hi, Barb.
Hi. This is a great program. Thank you so much.
Sure.
I'm a little bit of a new gardener, and I have these Stella Aura lilies. Mm-hmm. I've had for the first time, and I don't know when they get done blossoming, there's a little knob on the end, like a little round ball. Am I supposed to cut that stem off, or do I leave those on?
That would eventually develop into a seed, and on the Stella d'Oro daylilies and a lot of our perennial flowers, we usually may not leave those seed heads. In the case of the daylilies, the seed heads aren't very attractive, so I would definitely cut them off. And you cut off that entire blooming stem, so you can cut it all the way back down to near where the leaves are and get rid of them. Sometimes... I'll admit, I'm a lazy gardener. I will wait until they kind of dry out. Even sometimes you don't even get those little pods developing and you just end up with the stems that the flowers were on. I will sometimes even wait until those completely brown out and then just grab them with my hand and snap them out. So either one. But yeah, you don't need to do it. And you can do the same thing with if you don't like the seeds heads on the perennials, definitely, you know, cut them off, cut those stems off.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling.
Thanks a lot for calling. Someone was wondering about fertilizing flowers now, like the daylilies, for example. Once, do you fertilize those once they're done flowering or during flowering?
No. With most of the perennials, I do anything with a good establishment. So when I start the bed, I want to make sure I work a lot of compost and other things in. And so if you have pretty good soils, which we do in a lot of the state, most perennials don't need a lot of fertilization. Many of us mulch with organic mulches with shredded leaves or something like that. And as those decompose, they often add just enough so that you don't have to regularly fertilize. If the plants aren't doing well, if they're kind of light in color, they're spindly, then you might want to consider fertilizing. But the other thing is sometimes, especially if they start to die out in the center, that's the plant telling you it needs to be divided either in the fall or in the spring.
So there we go. Barb Larson, horticulture educator with UW Extension in Kenosha County. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking on this edition of Garden Talk with Barb Larson, a horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha County. Great to have her back. And again, thank you for listening in. Scott in Hayward has a question. Let's go to Scott. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. This is Scott, and this spring I built 9 raised beds because we didn't have a very good garden last year, and we brought in 10 yards of soil to put in there. And what I saw online was they suggested putting soaker hoses in the soil, which I did about halfway down, so that they're really, really watering the roots. And I actually, when it's hot out, the soil seems dry on top, but it is nice and moist down deep, and it really seems to be working. Our garden is looking fabulous.
That's a great idea. We have a number of Master Gardener projects where they're doing raised beds, and several of them do that. So, yeah, it works really well. One way, if you don't have that the soil mulched, you might want to use a nice organic mulch on top. That'll help keep that top layer a little bit moister, too, and also help prevent rain splash to help keep diseases, fungal leaf diseases and things off the lower leaves. So, yep, great idea. Glad you shared it.
Thank you very much for calling. Jeff in Beloit. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question actually is more on earwig control. I'm pretty familiar with gardening. I've been gardening most of my life. I'm 50 years old. Years ago, there was a product out called Diazina.
Yep.
And I know that was pretty much like a broad spectrum type of insecticide, but I can no longer find it anymore, and I think it's been banned. What else can we use to control earwigs now?
Okay, my favorite way to control earwigs, and it's not an official university recommendation, but it works, is I use a cottage cheese or similar size container, fill it about halfway with soy sauce. Just go buy whatever the cheapest soy sauce you can find and buy it in like the gallon size.
Okay.
So fill that container about halfway with soy sauce, and then pour just enough vegetable oil so that you have a skim, so a floating just across the top of that soy sauce of vegetable oil. Put that container in the middle of your garden or in your beds where you're seeing those earwigs. And the earwigs are attracted to the soy sauce. They get in there and they can't get out because they get greased up by the oil and they drown in the soy sauce. And it works incredibly well on reducing the number of earwigs and the earwig damage. And it's one of those you're not using any kind of insecticide or pesticide at all.
So you sink, right. Do you sink that in the ground or do you?
You don't even have to. Are you kidding? Lazy me. I just stand on top and kind of hide it so it's not really obvious that I've got this ugly little container in there. And we've used it in some of our demonstration gardens and all sorts of ways. And, it's even one of those that if the dog gets in and drinks it, well, they'll probably get sick from the dead earwigs, but it's not going to hurt anything else. So it really works well. But you are going to have to check it every couple of days and then dump out all the dead earwigs and then refill it.
Sure. Great. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Anne in Dubuque, Iowa. Hello.
Hi. How are you this morning?
Great. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I have some Alcea, the hollyhocks, that I planted from seed.
Uh-huh.
I have been unable to see the bug, but there's kind of a goldish yellow bump on the leaves, and it just really made the plant look horrible this year.
Right. Yeah. And then sometimes that goldish yellow bump drops out and it looks like you have little shot holes in there, right?
Correct.
In the leaves. Yeah. It's not a bug. It's a hollyhock rust. So it's a fungal disease. And it is one with most fungal diseases. Once you see the problem, there's not much you can do about it. But we have a great fact sheet. So if you go to the Wisconsin Horticulture webpage, so it's hort.uwex.edu. And you put in hollyhock rust, you should be able to get that fact sheet up. You can also go to the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, the same fact sheet's on there. So the University of Wisconsin diagnostic page. And it will tell you all about doing it or what you would do to treat it next year. This year, it makes your plants look bad, but it doesn't harm the long-term health of the plants. And you will want to, this fall, after the leaves and the plant dies back, make sure that you cut it off and that you do a good fall cleanup, too.
Okay. I've cut a lot of the leaves off.
Yeah. But it really doesn't, don't cut lots of them off, because at some point you're going to get to where it needs those leaves. And even though the leaves have spots or holes in them, the vast majority of the leaf is still good and is still functioning. So in this case, it's kind of spread in the plant anyway. You're not going to stop the spread very much farther. So I wouldn't do a lot of additional leaf removal now.
Okay.
Just so a call, fall cleanup.
Yep.
I'll do a good fall cleanup. Thanks very much.
Right. And then get the fact sheet, because that'll tell you about preventative fungicides.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. We have Nicole sent us on Facebook a photo of some bleeding hearts, if I'm not mistaken. And she has a question relating to them.
Except that photo is not bleeding hearts.
No, it's not. I wonder what that is.
I'm not sure what
not
it
a bleeding
is.
Heart.
Nope.
She's had bleeding heart. Well, I know she's had bleeding heart plants, and they've been really gorgeous. The last couple of years, very few hearts. Also, blooms. But the green part of the plant has become huge.
Okay.
So
what to do? A couple of things. One is, we talked a little bit earlier and mentioned earlier that sometimes when perennials start to die out in the center, that's one way of signaling that they need to be divided. Bleeding hearts usually don't need division, but another way a perennial plant signals that it needs division is if it starts blooming less. So that's a possibility. The other is, anytime we have a plant, and especially perennials, where we're getting lots and lots of green growth and you're not getting very much flower production, it could be that there's too much nitrogen fertilizer. So we also talked about not fertilizing very much, and especially perennials don't need very much fertilization. So if you're putting lots of fertilizer on there, quit it. I always tell people, don't be so nice.
That's right. That's when you get all that foliage.
Yes, because nitrogen tells it to grow leaves and not necessarily flowers. So I would also take a look at that.
Christine posted a link to a news story, too, that I think is kind of neat. There's a 170-plus-year-old grapevine at the Leocky Museum in Wausau.
Mm-hmm.
And is being restored by master gardeners and winery owner Nick McGinn. They're selling clippings, and they hope to have wine made from the grapes. That's kind of cool.
That is.
170-year-old vine. Lauren in Eau Claire, hello.
Hi. I have a question about rose bushes. We purchased a foreclosure home a couple years ago, and I'm trying to revive a old perennial garden that's on the side of the house. and I have more rose bushes than I know what to do with, and they're very green, but they don't have any flowers on them. I don't know what kind they are. They're not the traditional, what you would think of as a rose. They're just, you know, little pink flowers. They spread like crazy. I've found them in my yard, and they have lots and lots of foliage, and I've only had one flower this year. So I'd like to know if you have an idea of what kind they are, and second, if you'd have an idea of how I can make them bloom.
Well, the first thing I would want to do is, or suggest you do, is get a sample or pictures into your extension office so that you can identify it, or you can try to look it up. What I would want to rule out is it multiflora rose, which was planted in a lot of areas 50, 75 years ago, and it was supposed to be for animals. It actually has become an invasive species, so it's an invasive plant, and it does, when you told me, you know, it's spreading all over, you've got it all over the place, it's got that single pink, that sounds like it might be multiflora rose, and in that case, you want to get rid of it. You don't want to keep it. So especially if you're in an old farmhouse kind of situation, something like that, that's a good possibility of what it is. So if you, at that point, then if you rule out that it's not multiflora rose, are you pruning them at all?
I haven't been really, I don't know when, and that's what I was kind of wondering. I don't know when to do it, how to do it, because I don't, you know, I suppose it's a pretty hardy plant, so it'd be hard to prune too much, but I just kind of been pruning it to get it out of the way of the other flowers that I've been planting.
So many of the roses that are hardy, we would consider like a shrub rose, or even some of the, a lot of the climbing, or what are the old-fashioned rambler roses. In the spring, you treat them a lot like you do any other shrub, which is cut out about a third of the biggest, heaviest stems back at the ground line to help clean them up and get the size down. But I really think the first thing you need to do is get that identified so that you make sure that you've got a desirable rose to begin with.
Okay.
All right. Good luck. Thank you, Lauren, for calling. Clay and Kakana. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I got a question about some cherry trees. We bought them, and the person who sold us told us they're a mixed variety. The leaves will start green in the spring, then they turn purple, usually later May to June. And we get a ton of blossoms and very small cherries, but it seems like all the cherries dry up when they get like between BB and P size, and most of them fall off.
Okay, and has it done it several years now?
Yeah, ever since we got them, they're probably 10 or 11 years old. The trees have grown great, and it's just, I mean, they look nice with the purple foliage, but the cherries, like I said, they always dry up and fall off.
Okay.
And any new growth that comes on during the year will start out green, and then it turns purple, too.
Well, so first of all, most of our production cherries, I can't think of that have a lot of purple foliage. So I'm going, is this really a production one? Then the other is whenever we have fruits that are falling off about that size, next thing you start to wonder about is, are they getting properly pollinated? So that's another thing to look for. You're getting a lot of bees working the trees in the spring because when they're in bloom, because that has been an issue in many parts of the state. So are you noticing that?
I would think they are. I mean, they blossom out beautiful, and they'll be just loaded with the cherries.
Yeah, but are the bees, are you seeing bees in there when they're in bloom? Okay. The other is there are some diseases, so I would suggest you take a sample into the extension office and have them take a look at it, and or you may even want to send a sample to Brian Huddleston at the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, and send a 12-inch branch with the some of those fruits on there before they've dropped off.
Okay, one other thing these trees do. Is they spread underground a lot. They'll pop a lot of new growth up at the base, but even 3 or 4 feet out of their root system.
At Okay, so I'm now wondering if what's happened for you is that you've lost the cherry.
Yeah.
And you now have the rootstock.
Yep, I think that's what happened.
Yep. So you don't even have your desirable cherries anymore.
Okay.
What happened? happened? Your cherry was planted on a rootstock.
Yep.
That is different.
Right. Yeah. And sometimes it's cherry, sometimes it's plum. Because they're in the same family, they're all prunus. So, especially if you're getting, and that would explain why you're getting those reddish colored leaves too. So, I think you've lost your desirable crop. So, I would say unless you like them as a kind of wild shrubby thing, and you like it for the kind of ornamental characteristic, do not count on it for fruit production. And I'd start all over again.
Yep.
Okay.
All right.
Good to know.
Yep. Okay. Probably not what you wanted to hear, but
there
you have it.
Yeah, I was looking at Kakuna. You didn't even say, so you also want to make sure that you've got a really hearty cherry variety, too.
I had a Facebook question from Farah. My son's planted pumpkins, and I found squash bugs in them. The area's been squash-free for 5 years in hopes they would die off, but no luck. Anything I can treat the plants with to get rid of this pest or something the ground can be treated with once the garden is done this season? I'm not opposed to chemicals to rid my garden of this pest.
Okay. Well, there are recommendations for certainly insecticides that you can use for them. And I will tell you, I don't memorize all of the insecticides. So we do have another, this is another one. We have a great fact sheet on it. So the fact sheet will tell you the insecticides that are recommended for it. So I would definitely do that. Do a good cleanup. And sadly, squash bugs just seem to be one of our really common pests. A lot of people, and I know it's a real pain, will really keep a close eye and keep an eye on those leaves and examine them for squash bug eggs in June and squish the eggs. Or I even saw, where was that recently? Maybe it was even on your Facebook page, Larry, where somebody said they used fingernail polish and painted them.
That was on my Facebook page. Yeah.
I thought that was kind of interesting idea. So anything like that, that you try to reduce it. But I understand they're a real problem in some areas.
And we've had a few insect questions, and Phil Pelletieri will be on the show next Wednesday.
So there you go.
And he'll have some more, answers about insect questions for sure.
Mm-hmm.
We have Betsy in Germantown next. Hi, Betsy.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on the previous caller.
Yeah.
My guess is that this guy might have what's called a Schubert Canada cherry or Prunus virginiana, which is more of a ornamental than a fruit crop type plant. So you might want to, you know, you probably could pull that up on the internet, but that could be part of why what's going on there. For
right. And I did think of that, but Schubert is a tree. It's not a shrub. And when he's saying it's suckering out and that kind of thing, it could be, but that's why we talked about whether or not it could be an ornamental too.
Yeah.
So some of this is, I appreciate your sharing that because yes, that Schubert's do start out with those leaves that, and you get that color change in them. There's lots of different possibilities here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks, Betsy. And Bruce called it, wonders, is it okay to prune non-evergreen shrubs now? He doesn't know exactly what types of shrubs they are, but they're deciduous.
Generally, we don't like to prune in midsummer through early fall because it will stimulate new growth that may not harden off before wintertime. So we're getting to the point where we're kind of out of pruning season for our trees and shrubs, and we want to wait until probably October or so before you prune them, or spring.
And Joanne in Jacksonport. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. I had a plum tree that developed with an awful fungus that covers the stems and branches with this black, horrible stuff. And I tried just cutting out some branches, and I could see that wasn't going to work, so we took it down so it wouldn't infect everything in the world. And then the suckers that came up the next year and year, I cut those down. Now, I found that same kind of fungus on a really small sapling, oh, my goodness, 75 or 100 feet away from that tree. So I want to know what the best way to dispose of that is.
Okay, well, you have what's called black knot disease, and it's what our friend plant pathologist Brian Cuddleson calls poop on a stick, so
yeah.
Which is very descriptive. And it is incredibly common, and it infects many of our native Prunus family species, so our native wild plums, our native black cherries. So it's one of those that tends to make things look bad. Mm-hmm. And Brian's basic recommendation is prune it out. Mm-hmm. And it's so common that it's pretty much all over the place. So you're not going to just, you know, prune it out and prevent it from ever showing up again.
I realize that.
Yeah.
I want to know what to do with the thing when I prune it.
Oh, you can. Oh, when after you prune it, you can either burn it or bury it.
Okay, I wondered about burning it.
Yep.
I didn't know if that would release any spores. Or...
No, because it's so hot when you burn it, that helps to kill it out.
That would be my first choice.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Thanks a lot for calling. Paul in Little Suamico, your turn. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I've got a question on some chrysanthemums. 2 years ago, we planted some around our flagpole out in the front yard. The following spring, two of the three plants came back up. One never started again. We replaced that one in the fall, and this spring, none of them came up. I'm just wondering why they're not surviving the winter.
Okay, so my first question is, are you buying hardy chrysanthemums? Ones are sold as outdoor perennial plants.
I believe so. We bought them at Stein's.
Okay. All right. Because, a lot of us also are kind of a typical hospital plant that people get are mums. And those, in general, are not hardy for us. Sometimes you can get them through, but not always. So there's kind of a difference between the floral mums and the garden mums.
Yeah, I'm almost positive that it did say hardy mums.
Okay, okay. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that mums really don't like to have that freeze-thaw cycle in the wintertime.
Okay.
And so with a mum, you want to make sure that in the fall, after the foliage dies back, that you cut off the foliage and the stems. And then after the ground freezes or it gets really cold, then you mulch it so that it helps keep the ground cold. And that will help prevent it from going through that freeze and thaw. That tends to kill mums more than anything else.
Yeah.
Okay, now this is something I thought of while I was waiting for you to take my call. These are planted very close to being over the septic tank. Would the heat from that tank in the ground in the winter possibly be causing the problem?
Well, if it helped create that freeze-thaw
that
it would be back and forth, that could make it worse, yeah.
Okay, yeah, because it's very close to the edge of the tank. In fact, part of the flower bed is over the tank, and those flowers will be up 3 weeks before the rest of the flowers in that bed in the spring.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You may want to try mums someplace else.
Okay.
All right. Thanks,
okay.
Paul. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for calling.
Yep. Thanks a lot. Barb Larson, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha County. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller, here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio on this edition of Garden Talk. We visit with Barb Larson, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha County. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks a lot for listening in. Questions for her? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post a photo and question on my Facebook page. For that, just go to the Larry Mueller Show. Frances in Muskego has a question, so let's go there. Hi, Frances.
Hi. My question is, I have love lice blooming, or they've got that technical herb name, Arma, whatever it is, and my love lice blooming are about 3 feet tall, and right above the root, they get like a mush, and then they fall right over. When I pull it out, there's very little damage done to the root, but there is some damage, and the plant is, it's real healthy on top and just falls over. What causes that?
Well, if it's mushy, that sounds like a stem rot. So,
and what would cause that?
Too wet right at the ground line. So have you got them mulched?
No, this is on a hill, and it's in really dry ground. I don't know how they live, but they seed themselves every year, and they are beautiful plants because they get real tall, and then they put that umbrella arms out so pretty. But it's drier than sin on there. Nothing else lives, but they just love it.
But they live, but they're still getting mushy.
Yeah, they get that mush about 1 inch above the ground, just on the bottom of the stem and very little in the root.
Is it darkened or anything?
No, it's just mush.
Just,
huh.
I don't know, because mushy always makes me think of a disease, and usually the rot diseases. So I honestly don't have a good guess. You, if you really are really curious, this would be a great sample to send to the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic and see what's going on. There is a $20 fee for it, but
yeah,
that would tell you what it was.
I've sent other plants there, and I love the answers he gives me, but I never can get the, I don't know where you can get the things he recommends for, because stores like Stein's don't sell the remedy he recommends.
Well, usually what he's going to give you is the generic name for them, so it's not going to be the brand name, so sometimes you have to go...
Yeah. No, we've tried that, and it isn't working.
Okay.
I'm going to have to write him a letter on that.
You
and
do
can
that.
Can I ask you another real quick question? What would cause little bitty holes in all the leaves of my lupines, delphiniums, just little bitty, really small holes in all the leaves? And they're just, I don't know what causes that.
All right. I'm not sure. Have you gone out with a flashlight at night to see if you can find anything?
No, I have not.
Yeah, do that. Do some investigation.
I was going to ask you, what kind of holes do slugs make? Do they make little round holes?
No. They usually tend to be kind of raggedy holes in between the veins.
And how about those elder bugs or whatever you call those?
Oh, box elder bugs don't make holes.
No, but that other bug.
Earwigs, it would also make bigger holes than that, too.
Bigger holes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
Here I go. No help today.
There you go, Francis. Thank you for calling, and I'd go back to the plant disease diagnostic.
Oh, yeah. If you have questions, Brian is always very helpful. So,
Paul in Highland wondered if you can mulch on vegetable plants, like, you say, straw.
Absolutely. That's very typical one for vegetable plants.
What about freshly pulled weeds without seeds? Can you use them to mulch vegetables?
You know, I would put those maybe in my compost pile, especially if I had a hot compost pile and there weren't not only seeds, there weren't flowers on them, because so many of our weeds, if you pull them, if they have flowers on them, they'll still develop the seeds. But I wouldn't just toss them down. And I notice he's concerned is, will it take nitrogen from it? Not usually enough if you have decomposing organic matter that it's going to use that much. But I wouldn't use weeds. I mean, most of us, you want to get your weeds out of the garden, not leave them there.
Right. And vegetable plants do they benefit from having dead and dying foliage removed?
They're not doing anything any good for it anymore.
Yeah. Facebook question from Nicole. Who has butterfly weed in front of the house, clay soil. As far as I know, it's a variety that's supposed to do well. Today, the branches are drooping even after they've bloomed, and almost all my six plants are dead. There was something digging under them for a while that we have now taken care of. We read it. It could be root damage, but two landscapers have been to our house and don't know what it is.
Well, I mean, if there was a lot of digging where it disturbed the roots, or even sometimes if there's still tunneling left and the roots don't have, a lot of soil around them, especially with this hot and dry kind of conditions, that might be it. This is another one where if you're really going, why are these things dying? We wouldn't expect them to die. And, you know, you've done a little bit of watering, not overwatering, not underwatering. You know, this is one where if you really want to know, send a sample and have the plant clinic take a look at it. So I look into your cultural, you know, what else is going on with that, too.
Francis and Madison up next. Hi, Francis. Thanks for calling.
Well, hi. I have a mulberry tree. It is a regular tree. Mm-hmm. And the first branch about head height has a brown, it's brown all the way down to the ground, dripping down, and even about a foot out on the branch. But the branch itself still has green leaves.
Okay. Well, it sounds like it may be one of the canker diseases, and because some of those will ooze, and that's a fungus that grows right underneath the bark. And in some cases, they will ooze or drip a little bit.
Okay, this is quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, if you have where, as long as it doesn't completely encircle the branch, and so there's still sap flow out to the ends, you may get some dieback, but you could still have some green leaves on it.
Okay,
and boy, I'm giving Brian lots of business today.
Yeah,
but, but if this
is, it wouldn't pay to cut off the branch then.
Well, I mean, if you're going to have to make that decision on if it's,
I mean, would I get rid of this? For everything.
You know, I can't tell because I don't know what definitely is causing it. Some of these cankers, one of the things we do try to do is cut a branch off that contains it if the rest look healthy. Sometimes
yeah.
Just watering.
Okay, it certainly has a lot of ooze dripping down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, or this is, as I said, this is another one where you may want to see what's going on and have, when you cut that branch off, even send a section of it in to have it cultured and see what's causing it.
Yeah, worth a shot. Thanks for calling. Chris in Crystal Lake, Illinois, your turn next. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for the show. Appreciate
sure.
all the resources and inspiration that you guys provide us home gardeners.
Thank you.
Had a question. We've moved, and while we haven't got a nice garden in the yard, we've started up some pots, and we've got pretty good crop of tomatoes going. And at our previous residence, we had some blight, and I understand there's a couple different types of blight. Some are airborne, and then when it gets to the soil, you know, it gets soil-borne. But my question is, I'm using cages and stakes from our old yard. I'm going to be set myself up for another session of blight, or is there anything I need to do to treat those cages and stakes maybe next year?
Not usually, no, because it tends to be either airborne, and what we usually recommend is a good cleanup of clean up the leaves and that kind of thing. In containers, though, if you're growing a lot of containers and you have some disease problems, I would want to clean those pots out really well this fall or early spring. And usually what we recommend is a 10% bleach solution.
Okay.
Wash them out really well with that and then rinse them really well. So if you would have any kind of soil-borne fungi, that would take care of that.
There you go.
Okay, perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. And Gail in Wazika. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, what's on your mind?
We planted some fruit trees this spring, and a couple of apples, a couple of pears, a cherry, and a peach. And they're all growing really well. But we noticed on the apples that we have kind of a rust-colored spot on the leaves. And we followed the instructions really well. We got little packets, I believe it was, of calcium that you spread around it a couple months after you plant them, and we mulched around them and are, you know, keeping them watered. They said they recommended if you did not get an inch of rain per week, you know, you needed to water them accordingly.
Right. Yeah,
but
yeah.
I'm wondering about the rust-colored spots on the leaves, and is there a fertilizer that we should be using for these?
Well, first of all, a rust-colored spot. It's not brown or rusty that the edges are brown. It's a spot in the leaf.
Correct.
Okay, that sounds like probably one of our fungal diseases, and you're not doing any kind of preventative sprays on the apples.
Well, they're just new trees.
Yeah. So it could be that the variety that you have is susceptible to one of our fungal leaf diseases. Depending on the color, it could even be a rust disease if it's really a kind of an orangey color. Our other most common one is apple scab, and that tends to be more of a kind of a gray color. We were also talking this morning that they were seeing what's called frog eye spot, which is a little different on some of them. So this is another one. You could take a sample into your county extension office, and they could probably tell you what kind of leaf disease that is. It probably isn't hurting at this point the health of the tree, and I wouldn't do anything about it. And again, if it's a disease, it's any sprays are preventative. Fertilization, I do not recommend fertilization for newly planted trees and shrubs. You need for that root system to get established, and fertilizers encourage top growth instead of root growth. So don't fertilize. And then long term, you probably on your apples need to think about what kind of spray schedule you might want to use.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm all new to the fruit tree thing.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. All that information is on either the Learning Store and or the Horticulture webpage.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And just an email from Jeff in Fort Atkinson, who's a gardener at UW-Whitewater. He controls Japanese beetles by growing primrose and hops. They eat those plants nonstop, and the beetles leave his roses and hibiscus plants alone. Okay. It works very well for him.
You know, they've tried, that's a trap crop, and they've tried different trap crops over the years, and we've had gardeners that swear that if they plant a certain one, it keeps the beetles out. If it works for you, that's great, but what they found is it's not consistently working. So,
Barb Larson, our guest today. Barb is a horticulture educator for the University of Wisconsin Extension. She works out of Kenosha County, and she comes by the program every few months to talk with us about what's going on in the garden and to answer your questions. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Having a healthy garden is such a treat. Not only we get beautiful flowers and delicious vegetables, herbs, and fruits to enjoy, but, you know, tending a garden and spending time outside, it's great for your mental health as well. Larry Mueller here. We have a great group of horticulture educators working through UW Extension, really throughout the state. And several of them are regulars on Garden Talk, including our guest today, Barb Larson, who's a horticulture educator for Kenosha County with Extension. She has a wealth of information to share with you. And if you have a question, I hope you'll join us. 1-800-642-1234. You can also post a photo and or question on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And, of course, we'd love to hear from you. Watering has been on our mind. And David in Woodstock, Illinois, has a couple of watering questions, Barb. Is it bad to water in the evening versus the morning? Does it encourage disease?
Don't recommend watering in the evening if you're using something like a sprinkler so that you wet the leaves in the evening, because it takes longer for those leaves to dry out, and that means that that wet leaf surface makes them more susceptible to fungal leaf diseases. If you're watering in the evening and you're using, we talked about soaker hoses earlier, then you're probably okay with it.
And tomatoes, David says, I was told when you water tomatoes, you should avoid wetting the leaves. Is this true?
Yeah, and it's the same thing.
Same thing.
If you are watering them and you get the leaves wet, do that in rising temperatures rather than in the evening.
Marcia in Racine has a question. Hi, Marcia.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
I have an oak leaf hydrangea as part of a landscape plan, and it has gotten quite large. and it is starting to shadow out some of my other plants. When would be the best time for me to prune this back?
I think we're past the kind of time now, because that's one of those spring, early summer bloomers, and that you want to prune shortly after it blooms.
It's so, actually still blooming.
It's still blooming. Well, then you could, you know, shortly after it stops blooming. You can also, if you don't mind losing a few of the flowers, which I usually don't, I really like to do most of my shrubs in the spring before they leaf out, because I can see what I'm doing. I don't have to fight around the leaves. And these are the ones that you want to cut out the biggest, largest stems right back against the base of the crown of the plant. So against the ground line.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks. Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Let's see. Rick and Wheeler. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a question regarding sugar snap peas, my favorite, absolute favorite vegetable in the garden.
Okay.
For the last 3-4 years, I have not been able to get those seeds to even emerge. Maybe like 5% of them. And I'm wondering if you know if there's any issues with the genetics of that seed.
Not that I'm aware of. Have you switched varieties or cultivars?
Well, I'm not familiar with cultivars.
Well, cultivars would be the name, the variety.
Yes, so absolutely. I've tried everything. I've tried every brand.
And you moved them to a different part of the garden?
Yes.
Okay, and you're planting them in spring?
Yes.
Okay, and have you checked if they're not emerging very well? Are you checking to see if they're rotting?
I really have not, but I have gone so far as to try to plant them in the little cardboard containers with starter soil.
Yeah.
And I have looked at those, and yeah, they seem to rot. I've only tried that once now this year. I went to that extent, and I did see some of those seeds when I dumped them out, and I would guess they were rotted.
Okay, they were soft or mushy?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that sounds like rot. I guess the other thing you might want to try is the old paper towel germination test, too. And put them in a damp paper towel, roll them up, and because they're a pea, they like cool temperatures. So you want to keep them in a, you know, room temperature or slightly cooler place, and then check them. Peas usually germinate fairly quickly, but see if does the little root come out? Do they swell, and does the root come out, and do they start looking healthy? If not, then I'd question, you know, the quality of the seed themselves.
Yeah.
And you're using new seed every time.
Yes, absolutely. I have tried. I have tried old seeds and several different new types of seeds.
Yeah, but they're actually new seed from a manufacturer, and they're good quality seed.
I believe so, because we've got a couple of really good places up here, you know.
Okay.
So everything from soup to nuts, and I was wondering if it's in my head.
Well, maybe it's, how much are you watering?
Watering, yeah, that's the other.
That's the only other thing. If you're watering too much, you're going to get that.
Yeah, they will rot. And this year, we had a lot of problems with the early planted stuff because it was so cold and wet. So I would throw this year out as a kind of test that it would not be a good year for peas and other kinds of those spring crops, because a lot of them rotted this spring because it was too cold and wet for them to germinate. So I would say move it to another spot. Definitely start with new high quality seed. Make sure that you don't overwater, that it's not too wet where you're planting it.
Yep. I'd go with go to one of the good garden centers
online
Jungs or one of those.
Mm-hmm.
You'll get some good quality seeds. Ann in Madison, thank you for calling. Hello.
Yes, hello. Thank you very much. Great program, very informative.
Okay, I live in an apartment, so I garden in pots. And this year, first time, I'm trying zucchini in large pots. And they look great, lots of flowers, and then the fruit comes out, looks great. And when it gets to be about 3-4 inches long, then they start yellowing at the tips, and progressively the whole fruit becomes yellow and then orange and dies, and then I get more fruit.
Okay, now this is going to sound like I don't mean to insult you. It's not a yellow zucchini.
No.
Okay, because some of them are yellow.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. No, and they do look beautiful, green, dark green. I think they're the black beauty. And when they become all yellow and then orange, I mean, they're totally stunted.
Yeah, this is another one. Are they soft and mushy at the end?
No. I don't think
so. So they're turning brown. Is it
yellow and then orange?
And then orange. And the whole fruit turns yellow and then orange.
Yes, and it stops growing, and then it sort of like shrivels, and I can just
pick it off.
Yeah.
Is it too much water? Too little water?
That would be one of the things I would take a look at is what's your watering regime. You want to keep that potting soil moist but not soggy. And most of our container grown plants have to be watered once or twice a day. So, with a container, my favorite way is I stick my finger down into the pot and see how moist it is.
It's pretty root bound. So I keep adding soil, but it's in a huge pot and I do keep watering. I wasn't sure if it's a disease or?
Well, I don't know that it doesn't necessarily sound like a disease. And I don't know, I wouldn't add soil to it. You don't need to add more soil on top of it.
Okay.
So I would keep that evenly moist, and especially if it's root bound, even in a large pot, that means that it's filling up all that space. And so you really are going to have to watch the amount of water in it and keep it moist.
Yep.
Maybe too little water.
Possibly, or could be too wet and it's damaged the roots too.
Yep.
So, because too wet and the roots are damaged, it looks like too little water.
Yeah.
Because it can't take up the water.
Anne, thank you for calling and good luck to you. Appreciate it. I want to give Clarice a chance to join in from Viroqua. Hi, Clarice.
Hi. Yeah, I'm Clarice.
Yeah.
And I have a hibiscus that is probably 5 years old, and it has been magnificent until this year. And this year, it has been like 6 and 7 feet tall with hundreds of blooms. This year, it is maybe 6 branches came up, and they are short and they're not full and rich like they were before. It's on the south side of our house, and I know that the spring was cold and damp, and I know that hibiscus are slow to come up again, but I'm wondering, is it dying out? Are they a limited plant? What could it be?
Well, if it makes you feel any better, the hibiscus on the south side of my house looks the same way.
Oh. Do you think it's a season?
I think it's last year's season. You know, remember, hibiscus are one of those that they like hot temperatures, but they also like a good amount of water. And so we're still seeing some impacts on drought from the drought of last year. And in a lot of cases, these shrubs just are not as vigorously growing as they have in previous years. So I just kind of hang in there. I'm just kind of keeping my fingers crossed on mine and not doing a lot except that making sure I keep it watered this summer if it dries out. And I'm not adding a lot of fertilizer or anything. I want to just kind of sit and wait and see what it does.
Okay.
But what kind of, when I fertilize it, and I've not been actively fertilizing it ever.
I wouldn't.
What would I use?
I wouldn't fertilize it.
Okay.
I would make sure you use an organic mulch And I would just kind of keep an eye on it and make sure that you watch the amount of rainfall we're getting and water so that we don't add drought stress again this year.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Okay.
Well, thanks a lot for calling.
And we'll both kind of see what happens.
Yeah. Barbie mailed us and wondered about cutting back established peonies. Can she do that now?
No.
No.
No. Any of these perennials, I want to keep that foliage up so that it can photosynthesize and store those carbohydrates to make it through the wintertime.
And Tom wonders about his hybrid tea rose. He has one that's half was converted back to a wild rose. The other half is the hybrid tea.
Yeah. This isn't one where what's happened is it's coming back from the roots. The hybrid teas have separate rootstock and then the tea part. And so what you want to do is cut those suckers back, that what you're calling the wild rose, cut those all the way back down to the roots or where below the graft site is, and try to get rid of that. And then hopefully your desirable hybrid tea will remain alive.
Joanne in Platteville. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I have a plant that looks like Queen Anne's lace when it's in bloom, but I was told it's not Queen Anne's lace, and it's taking over my yard. And somebody called it either snow on the mountain or goat's beard.
Looks like Queen Anne's lace.
When it's in bloom.
When so it's in the bloom.
White. You have the white, but it's not Queen Anne's lace. It's not quite as flat on the top as Queen Anne's lace. It's kind of more, there's white flowers that look like it, but it kind of... it's
okay.
Kind of concave.
All right.
Part of the flower.
Okay.
And it's growing. It kills everything in our yard. It's a ground cover. When it starts out real low to the ground. It just is the green foliage, the leaves. And then when it gets bigger and taller and looks like Queen Anne's lace, it has some white flowers. And it's killing everything.
Okay.
And I think I've pulled the same plants out now for, 15 years, and they keep coming back.
And I see you're looking for organic, and there really isn't anything that would be organic. It sounds like it's a perennial.
Yeah.
And so with the perennials, basically what you're doing is keep pulling it out. The organic herbicides are all what are called burn down, so it basically just kills off the top of the plant. It doesn't kill out the roots.
Okay.
So they're going to continue to resprout. So it doesn't make any difference whether or not you would pull them out or whether you, use one of those organic herbicides that kills off the top. You'd have to, it's going to be a continual battle.
It has been a continual battle.
Yeah.
Feeling like we just want to plow up the whole yard.
And in some cases, our turf specialists, if you have over 50% weed, they actually recommend that you start all over again.
Yeah.
Really?
Yep.
Yeah. We did that on one of our lawns years back now. It's been a long time, but we started all over. You know what? It was fine.
Yeah. In some cases, that is the best way to do it, is to start all over. And you have a little bit of time, because if you're going to do that, that late August through early September is prime time to to establish a lawn or to renovate a lawn.
Yep.
Okay. And then the second question I have is about ornamental grass. Same problem. It's killing our roses. It's killing our daylilies. It's killing everything. And we're trying to pick it by hand and pick it when it's little, but it just keeps overtaking the yard. Any suggestions? It's a really tall ornamental grass it grows to be like 9 feet tall. It's huge.
Yeah. Well, it's the same thing. We're all talking again about a perennial. And, if you're kind of stick with those organic kinds of things, the options are the same.
Yeah. Either that or just move to a different house, right?
Yeah.
Or learn to like it.
Yeah.
Well, I like it. It killed our raspberries. It's killed our... I think it takes a lot to kill rhubarb, but it killed our rhubarb.
Wow.
Yeah, that's the problem with some of those early ornamental grasses, where they're pretty invasive. They didn't stay nice clumpers. They kind of run all over the place.
They run all over the place.
Yeah.
So if it's over 50% of the area we want, then you're saying it would be best to maybe take it all down. And how do you take it all down? Just, what do you mean?
Well, part of it's, you can dig it out all out. Some people like to, you know, take it completely out of cultivation for an entire growing season. And so
and then there's Roundup.
And, yeah. Larry's going to say, yeah, there's glyphosate. So, you know, you're going to have to make a decision on that.
Right. Okay. Are you familiar with what this plant is? I mean, it isn't Queen Anne's lace, but it's very similar to it. Do you know what that plant is?
You know, there are several. Snow on the Mountain. I wonder if it's Snow on the Mountain Bishop's Cap. Is it turning brown now?
It kind of starts out brown and then the flowers turn white.
No. The leaves browning.
Oh, yes.
Okay, then it does sound like it. Quite often, it can be invasive, but if you let it really dry out, it doesn't like hot, dry conditions. I remember back quite a number of years ago, I was doing a program, and they had somebody that was from the South that came up for a box store opening, and he was the expert, but they asked the extension person to be there. And he was recommending Snow on the Mountain or Bishop's Weed, as it's sometimes called also. Yeah. And I said, no, not here.
No.
And he says, well, it's not a problem in the South. I said, yeah, because it gets too hot there. But up here, it's a real problem. So,
yeah, actually, Bishop's Weed, that's what somebody called it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's
keep after it.
Happy to hear that.
Yeah.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Matt in the UP, let's turn to you next. Hi, Matt. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hey, Larry, I have a question regarding vermiculite.
Okay.
And specifically construction-grade vermiculite. I had the bright idea as we redid our house. I had an attic full of vermiculite and a clay garden, and the two just seemed to match so perfect. So I put all my vermiculite in my garden. I've been recently told that vermiculite may be full of asbestos, and I'm concerned that I maybe just turned my garden into a big carcinogenic mess.
Construction vermiculite is treated differently than horticultural vermiculite. Not a good idea at this point.
Did you work it into the soil?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know right now what the state of Michigan State University Extension and soil labs and some of that kind of thing is. So you could either contact your Michigan State Extension office, whatever's nearby, and talk to them about it and see if they have a soil testing or how they would recommend that kind of testing. I know a lot of our agriculture educators that are right along that border. Scott Royce, for instance, who's Marinette County, does handle some of those kinds of questions and things, too. So you could also contact Scott.
Yeah.
If you're close to that area.
Yeah.
I am.
Okay. All right. That's what I would do. Then contact Scott and see about, possibly looking at trying to get some testing or something done, too.
If it's worked into the soil, frankly, I have no idea.
Well, the question is what is in that vermiculite? Was there, how old was it? Was there asbestos in it also? Or sometimes those are just treated with different chemicals, or how they're processed to begin with is a little bit different. So you might want to grow grass in that spot and garden someplace else.
Oh, that's...
That might be the best, easiest option.
Yeah, that's a very good idea, I think. Yeah. But
Larry and I think so.
Yeah, that'd be what I'd be doing.
Yeah.
But you might want to check and make sure. Barb, the time flew here, didn't it?
It does. It's summertime
and time to get back out in the garden. Thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Barb Larson, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha County, our guest. And you know what? We'll have her back and we'll do this all over again. Monday at 11, we'll talk about geocaching. That's a great activity for kids and adults alike. That's at 11. Then at 11:45, we'll talk about recent archaeological findings at Aztalan in southern Wisconsin. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.